medical number. Yourself. And I don't know if our colleagues are still on the way. But Harry would just have to start now so that we don't have a problem later. I know some members that are about 11 to 12 would like us to be done by that time. I had a discussion yesterday with the deputy chief whip of the majority party, who is part of the programming and all fixed as well in the forum of his chief forum. Some colleagues have raised the issue of where we're going, how we're going to debate, especially with respect to NIDA, or NIDA as they call it. We know that it falls under DPMP. Should I say administratively? I don't know whether administratively is the right word. But also in the presidency. Now, it looks like the feeling is that the debate will not be in the NTPP, but in the president vote. So I just thought that maybe I should check that so that when we prepare a debate, and members would want to refer to it during the debate, I'm sure members are always debating, really want to debate, but I understand that the full debate will be done with president. So I thought that I should just address that. And maybe we can come to the business of the day and welcome the acting chairperson of the FSC and the team. I don't know where acting chairperson. Maybe we need to do a little bit of homework opportunity in terms of I do know with the bureaucracy that the rules of the public service and administration have got certain guidelines in terms of the acting, how long acting takes. Now, I guess we don't fall under that category. But I think what we need to find is exactly where do you fall in terms of in your career responsibility as a leadership. Well, thank you very much for coming this morning. On Tuesday, we had the a presentation by National Treasurer on the appropriation bill B1 of 2013. A number of points were raised, and the FFC is no one to be seen to be copying. The design of Oka Matos Korean, if you peep on the other people's presentation. But geography didn't want to pass on that. But we welcome the presentation. We thought that because of the importance that we attach on this presentation, we'll only have one presentation this morning so that we are not rushing too much and so our members can really engage with the issues that we had raised. We had raised, especially with the respect to issues of infrastructure and with the budget, how the budget gives effect to the priorities of government. We really appreciate that you have recorded so that you can to us. Maybe at this stage I can invite you to address it. We have the RF from National Terror, but they say that it's here as an observer. I guess that in the new Vatican person, welcome Mr. Maruk, right? Sorry?
Maruk.
Morocco, yeah. In Morocco. You're welcome. Mr. Komala, how about you as well?
No, thank you, Chairperson. Thank you also to honorable members. Let me start off by introducing my team. I've got on my left Dr. Ramos Mapungu. He is our Research Director, and I've got on my right Sasha Peter. She is one of our research specialists. And the guest speaker, Abdul Khalid Dawood, is a program manager for provincial sphere. And I also have Henry Epstein, who is the parliamentary liaison officer. Now, I think you have correctly put with respect to what you requested us to do, and we basically there are four key areas that you raised in your letter. Firstly, is a general assessment of the bill with regard to affecting government's five priority areas, an assessment of infrastructure investment in national government, an assessment of possible institutional arrangements or mechanisms that can stimulate cost efficiency and any other related matters that the Commission may deem as important. So we tried to look at all of these things in exactly the same way that you requested. I think the key message that we can draw from our assessment of the bill is that there needs to be a concerted effort on the part of government to address the root causes of poor performance across the board. Without addressing those root causes of poor performance, we will continue to have negative sentiments expressed about the standard of South Africa's fiscal governance and therefore fiscal prospects going forward. I think it's important that we actually look at what we have with all the constraints and all the demands on the priority side. We need to ensure that we get effective delivery out of government programs, irrespective of the amount of money that's been put there. I think there are quite a number of concerns with the way in which public resources are being utilized. And again, it's important to highlight that if one looks at the Auditor General's findings for 2011-12, it shows that the outcomes have been stagnant the Section 100 intervention that were implemented in 2011 and ran through 2012 basically are an indication of some of those problems that this government is facing, irrespective of what the resources available are going to be. Now, it's important that from our side as a commission, we don't view these challenges as simply a matter of technical financial management intervention. But also, we think it's important to deal with the political administrative interface relating to human resource management, organizational systems, and the capacity of the state in general. And an example here of an attempt at addressing these basically in respect to regulations in the local government sector, where the MFMA is very clear on what type of people must be employed in what type of positions. And also the Systems Act tries to also strengthen that same kind of system by introducing certain specific competency criteria that different types of managers must actually meet in the system of government. Now, at a provincial level, we don't have those kind of efforts to try and actually ensure that we employ the right people and we deal with this political administrative interface where sometimes this kind of relations interfere with the capability of public servants to deliver their work. So basically, we ask a question about the Public Finance Management Act, whether it has actually achieved what it was intended to do. And I think if one looks at the PFMA, in terms of almost a majority of the range of problems that the Auditor General picks up, it's around compliance, it's around compliance with regulations, or compliance with laws around authorized or unauthorized expenditure. It's around all sorts of things that the PFMA was designed to actually regulate. But in terms of the implementation and in terms of the consequences for those things, there has not been a very clear story coming out of what the consequences are, especially where such violations are repetitive. They actually happen over and over again. So you keep coming up with the same kind of findings. So if we're saying that the outcomes are stagnant, what we're saying is that there's no improvement. In some cases, there's probably a worsening of that. So we can talk about whether the envelope is sufficient to fund the kind of priorities that we have, which is what the key story around this is. The question that still remains are around the effective utilization of those resources that have been made available. And so with that kind of a background, I would like to hand over, Chairperson, to Dr. Ramos Mapupu and Mrs. Sasha Peters to take you through the presentation. And then we'll come back and close.
Okay, thank you. Morning, honorable members and colleagues. I'll start by sketching the macroeconomic and fiscal outlook because that gives a background to the priorities and where the Commission feels we are at in terms of giving effect to those priorities in the budget. Now, when one looks at the macroeconomic field over many years, here by many years, I'm referring to, say, a window of 100 years, what you see is that the views on fiscal policy have been changing quite dramatically in those 100 years, moving from views that fiscal policy has got no effect whatsoever on the economy, views that are associated with economies like Keynes, where the activist fiscal policy was seen as the way to go, coming back again to views where that was Now we are focusing more on issues of sustainability around the fiscal policy, looking at issues such as macroeconomic stability, budgetary stability, and how affordable the proposals that are being made. So that's where we are, and where we are emphasizing more sustainability of fiscal policy. And when you want to think of it in terms of budget review, currently under review, this informs what government is coming up with when it talks of the long-term fiscal modeling, long-term fiscal analysis that they are talking about. It's address issues of sustainability that is currently on the radar. For South Africa, the economy remains vulnerable to the two areas that we spoke to last time that we met with this committee. And these are the slow global recovery that continues up to today. And then the addressing sectors that are associated with the violent labor conflict and service delivery protests. So in terms of parameters underpinning future prospects for the economy, we still find in those two areas. With that, the government tabled a budget of 1.2 trillion for when the budget was announced, with 47.6% of that going to the national and 43.5% to provinces, and the remaining 8.9% to the provinces. Now, if we can move on. That graph shows you over a long period how the economic growth rate for South Africa is moved compared to the rest of the world gross domestic product. The rest of the world is the black line and South Africa is the red line. And what you see quite starkly there is how well those two lines follow each other. In other words, development on the world economy quickly feed into development on South Africa. You could even not live in South Africa and monitor what happens on the global economy and still be able to say how the South African economy is likely to perform the following year just by knowledge of the drivers of the world economy. It's an amazing close relationship between those two. And again, what's quite fascinating is when you look at the period 1992 to 2007, we've been experiencing positive economic growth throughout that period. We cannot be where we went below negative economic growth. The only negative economic growth was the recession induced, world recession induced 2008, 2009, that we spoke to this committee, we know what was explaining that deal. And that was the first recession in 19 years, because the last one had been around 1992. We've started to slowly recover, as you can see, but we are not yet where we were prior to 2007. That red line is above zero, but it's still way below where we were 2008. There's still a lot of room to make up. Moving on, Sasha. This picture tells you an interesting story about development in the budget deficit in a proportion of the size of the economy of gross domestic product. And then what we see is that from budget surpluses prior to 2008, the first two rectangles that are in the negative, they mean that we're actually running budget surpluses. We've consistently been running a budget deficit since the onset of the crisis, with the highest one being in 2009-2010 because of the counter-cyclical policy where we needed to respond quite fast to the recession that I spoke about. But what you legislation having set in way back in 2009, the fiscal finances are still not recovered. When you look at the 2012-13 to 2015-16, in other words, current MPEF, the red line versus the gray line shows you what the government says it plans to do versus what actually comes out in the budget. And the interesting story there is that you can no longer take macroeconomic or fiscal stability for granted, because ideally the gray and the red lines should be exactly the same if what you plan is what comes out. But you can see that increasingly over the MTEF, the gray line is below the red line, which means we are missing on targets that we have set ourselves for consolidating. Only in 2015-16 we see the two rectangles coming together. So in terms of the interesting macroeconomic question is what explains us successfully consolidating in 2015-16 around 10% of budget deficit that we have been unable to do in all other years. So this is why we say we can no longer take for granted the legacy of fiscal prudence that South Africa has built, because you can see those two rectangles are not coinciding. They are gaps that have increasingly been building up. Moving on, Sasha. That takes public debt as a percentage of gross domestic product over the years. And looking at the current MTF, what you see is your public debt, the proportion of output, the red four graphs there, going up from 86.3% of the economy before petering off at around 14.3% of the economy in 2015-16. So we see one of the areas where the legacy of not fully consolidating coming to fall in those red lines, where our public debt is gradually building up to 40.3. But again, when you look at a long-term historical perspective, and this is almost like a 2020 cricket budget for the following cricket, you can see that in terms of heights, we haven't scaled the heights that we were scaling around 1994-95, for instance, but we are gradually going up, especially when you compare to 2007-08, for instance, where we were sitting at 23.3, and now almost double that within a space of 5-6 years. So that always puts a red light on where one is going. Moving on, Sasha. This is the picture that brings in most of the planning around macroeconomic circles. That plots the gross debt to GDP ratio compared with peer economies. So while from our perspective, the level of debt to GDP is not unusual, what you see there is that those lines cross out. Compared with peers, South Africa is growing much faster in terms of debt accumulation. And that is the picture that scares off most people that are commenting on our debt problem. So it's not really the level of debt, but it's the trajectory that from where we were sitting way below our peers, we crossed past around 2011 and are now consequently above our peers. So that is actually the picture where when people speak about questions around fiscal prudence, they are focusing on. It's not on the magnitude or level of the debt. really within range or below range when you take a long-term perspective. It's just that trajectory where it has suddenly popped up above what we consider to be our peers. Moving on, Sasha. This looks at real cost of expenditure components. The last MTF compared to the current MTF. And as you can see there, the many interesting stories in the plan. The last MTF, where you have those high rectangles, are definitely substituted by lower rectangles. In other words, there's an intention to consolidate the budget. The biggest drop is that red rectangle. That speaks to your compensation of employees by government. Falling from an average of 8.3% to just 1.3% over the MTF in terms of compensation for employees. Another area that worries a lot of policy analysts is the issue of transfers to households, what is in the main your social grants. And as you can see, and as we have been pointing over the years, this is not really one of the big problem areas for government. It was at 5.2% in the previous MTM, and now it's at 3%. It's in our long-term projections, say, given population growth rate. That's not where the action really is. In fact, South Africa should be proud of managing to run a successful social safety net that is ensured solidarity amongst its citizens. So the interesting storyline around the red line that is really taken a knock from 8.3 to 1.3%. You also see the debt service cost becoming the highest driver of your current expenditure at 4.5, keeping within the consolidated framework. So for this point, I think those are the two areas for discussion. The increase in debt service costs and the drastic fall that compensation of employees is taken in over the new MTF. Move on, Sasha. When we do the fiscal sustainability, which I said is the current fog within fiscal policy analysis, one key channel that's often ignored and that is relevant for priorities is, of course, the impact, that picture that we've shown comparing the two MEFs, previous one and the current one, actually have an economic growth. Because economic growth ultimately is what feeds into facilitating those priorities that we're going to talk to. So we need to understand that although we're seeing a consolidating picture, but what is its effect on economic growth? And as I said, the biggest knock that we have seen is on compensation of employees. That's taking up from 8% to just over 1%. And we know that what has been sustained economic growth rate, the 2.5% growth rate that we spoke about during the budget, is actually being consumption. So out of your drivers of economic growth, consumption has been carrying GDP growth rate. Now when you strangle compensation for employees by that amount, what it means is taking away one lever, because compensation of employees feeds into that aggregate called consumption. So you are going to expect quite a knock on economic growth by the choices that have been made to consolidate. So we will accept that consumption will not be a driver of economic growth. 2.5% gross domestic product consists of consumption, investment, government expenditure, exports, and imports. So what remains to take the slack would be investment. So the actual strategic issue here would be whether the promised infrastructure expenditure will sufficiently absorb the slack that is created by the demise of private consumption in the system. And that's where the growth prospects for the medium term are going to play themselves out, whether the infrastructure expenditure is sufficient enough to counteract the declining private consumption. And I'll come back to this. This requires that one project into the future. And from our projection, and given the magnitude of the infrastructure spending that is on the table, and all sorts of assumptions about its productivity, we think that can absorb the slack that is left by the consolidated MDF profile. But it all hinges on productively implementing the expenditure strategy that we talked to. And as the ex-chairperson was talking in his introductory remarks, we have a lot of question marks about effective implementation of the infrastructure strategy, particularly at the national government level, in terms of simply spending the money in the proposed areas and generating the productivity effects that are required to keep economic costs up. So to summarize the macroeconomic picture that we've painted, on the downside risks will point to the continued global economic deterioration, which we saw track pretty much South African economic growth rate. There has not been much change to the 2009-2010 picture, and the world continued to look groggy at best. And if we believe that narrative that we saw over more than 20 years tracking the South African economic growth rate, that it follows closely world development, we are likely to be groggy. There are risks associated with that. The second risk is there could be another financial meltdown on the global. Another financial meltdown from the global. Nobody really knows how we're going to handle the American debt situation, for instance, or the situation the American economy finds itself in. And that is potential to again destabilize the whole financial system and perhaps mutate the whole recessionary outcome. The third one are the domestic issues that we spoke about, potential downside risks. We've seen that they put a knock on short-term cost domestic product. The fourth risk, downside risk, is one associated with structural features. In other words, that our unemployment levels continue to be as high as they are, further leading to social disturbances. And the recent numbers that have come out of the quarterly labor force survey suggests that we are still above 25% unemployment. So the structural problem could continue with us, further causing another downside risk. On the upside, we hope that the huge stimulus package being experimented with in the developed economies work out. And if those work out, it means the world cost profile improves and our cost prospects increase. So there is the upside risk in the sense that the world is doing something about its own recession and we've seen how that tracks our system. And then the infrastructure spending that I've just spoken to, if that is articulately and effectively implemented, that can bring with it not just the cover for declining consumption as a driver of economic growth, but put us on a sustainable economic growth footing. So those two will be the upside prospects for the economy over the years, counteracting the four risks that I've said. Now moving on, Sasha, to the priorities. There are four overarching ones that inform the submission that we prepared for you. Promoting economic support and development, investment in infrastructure, job creation, and enhancing local government capacity. So I'll speak to those before my colleague Sasha comes to speak to the other two issues that you also requested us to talk on, which are issues around how to any thought we have on how to implement cost efficiencies and any other matters that we think the committee should be aware of. Now, in terms of promoting economic support and development, looking at the proposed numbers, our assessment is that the key elements to support supply side economic policies are in place. You have education, infrastructure, energy, competition, and regulation policy, all with some sense of prioritization, including science and technology, which actually sees quite a big jump. And we think that points to the fact that the infrastructure spend that we spoke about, there will be a pipeline of engineers and scientists and mathematicians and policy analysts who will handle that infrastructure. And so depending on science and technology tells us that the key elements for supporting economic policy are there for our future costs. But moving to the next slide, when we dig deeper into the submission of here, although provinces have got significant instruments to shape their own spending programs in terms of education and skills and health, the well-being of society, which are important support mechanisms for economic growth, we think there is a lot of room that is required to enhance their abilities to shape establishment of clusters and key sectors, which are crucial for subsidizing our economic costs. So there is need for more work on enabling provinces to get capacity to set up those economic clusters so that they are able to reap the economies of scale, create the spillovers that are required and lead to a sustained economic growth. A main concern is that, of course, the national is not set up norms and standards for concurrent functions. And the result is that you find the funding of a standard basket of social and economic services varying across provinces. And as a result, you get varying qualities across provinces. And that does not work well for a well-crafted, self-sustaining economic cost profile where you get the differences across the main provinces. Municipalities promote economic development through provision of basic services, water, sanitation, electricity distribution, and so on. The local equitable share funds the provision of those basic services. And the revisions that have been proposed to the local equitable share for which the commission has a part of in that review, we feel will go a long way towards addressing the shortcomings with the previous arrangement. And the commission fully supports the new formula that is in place in terms of trying to address the economic support capacity of the local government, particularly for the rural municipalities that were suffering a lot at the previous formula for the reform. Now, coming to investment in infrastructure, a lot hinges on this. The development that has taken place is that there is now a Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, a PICC, that was established in 2011. And its main responsibilities are to identify, prioritize, and coordinate the infrastructure development. And our last count, 18 strategic integrated projects has been prioritized. The way to understand this strategic intervention is to say that a lot of the projects that we have are mere proposals. They may not be bankable or shovel ready to essentially take off. So what PICC is set out to do is how to move from a concept to something that can take off or be shuttled. And at the moment, there are those 18 projects that are, so to speak, on the doorstep of the bank to take off. The majority of the projects fall within the ambit of local government and focus on electricity distribution, addressing maintenance, develop, upgrading water, and creation of sustainable urban settlement. And this is going to be a vital component of government policy. Moving on to the next slide, 8.2 billion has been allocated to provinces, mainly for social infrastructure. Our concern again today is over poor planning and the critical skill shortages in provincial infrastructure delivery. So close scrutiny on the spending of those grants should continue to be a wetland for the colleague. I was listening to my colleague before we started the gentleman sitting next to Honorable Sogoni, and I was saying part of the oversight that has to be that it's not that you go in a short book that says this is the end of 22 billion plan, but actually ask where is the power station or where is the dam? Show us the dam, because all these games look extremely nice on paper, but we need somebody that actually goes and say, show me the dam, show me the then at the local government level, the infrastructure fund is through a conditional grant fund. Mainly through two vehicles, the one for water through the newly created municipal water infrastructure grant, and then there is the integrated national electrification program, INEMCO. Moving on, Sasha. Now, one big question is, of course, how sustainable is the public expenditure to fund infrastructure, and how credible is that plan? And as I said, we've looked into that. And our assessment of the infrastructure plan, that's on paper, is that for the short term, don't expect a big kick on gross domestic product. That will be negligible. But in the long term, if that infrastructure plan is actually put in place, there's going to be a long-term cost dividend that is huge. future. And that dividend of economic growth actually allows the economy to pay for itself. It is a financial dividend. So the argument is that even debt financed infrastructure spending can pay for itself in the long term. So when we are discussing how finance infrastructure plan, we know that communal banks are a big player, developing financial institutions, etc. Debt finance ones can actually yield a big dividend in the cell where government floats bonds to finance infrastructure. But it has to be well executed for it to get those long-term returns. Moving on, Sasha. Now, coming to job creation, again, unemployment consistently high in the last 2 decades, then that places huge constraints on the revenues, which fall because less people than the economy has employed, and the expenditure on those people to keep them alive must go up. Over the MTF, government has maintained job creation as a key priority. And the key initiatives that one sees in the government plan are the community work program, the social sector expanded public work program, grants for provinces and for municipalities. And the view is that from the new growth path, the 2010 growth path, the National Development Plan, and the Industrial Policy Action Plan, the various versions of them, is that in a nutshell, increased capital expenditure by government will help to meet the job creation target. And our analysis that we tabled last year is pretty much that infrastructure expenditure on its own is not going to be sufficient to generate the kinds of jobs that we are looking at. We need to also focus on shifting the skills. We need to focus on regulatory constraints. We need to focus on small micro and medium enterprise sector. And when you look at the next slide, it shows you that in terms of the employment that we've been experiencing over the long term, that red line is what government has been employing. As you can see, by far, the biggest contribution coming from government. But I want to draw your attention to the two bottom gray and black lines. That gray line that has just gone above the black line are the black line keeps losing out are your big enterprises. So if they're going to run an expansive infrastructure strategy, it addresses the black line. But where are most of the jobs coming from? Pretty much from that gray area, which talks to your medium scale enterprises, your services enterprises, etc. So we've seen a change in trajectory in terms of who is driving the job, and that's why we argue that infrastructure spend on its own, it will take a heck of a job to turn that black line to address 25% unemployment. And so what one needs to focus on in the main how to continue nursing the gray line that has already started going up with the support structure that's in place, and address the questions around the red line, which is government. And the question there being, do you increase compensation or wages in the OTC that is the continued driver for employment? And we want to take that to the plan that I've spoken to, the new COPAC, the National Development Plan, and the IPAP, for instance. The answer is that government should be seen as an compensation being forced down to 1.3% compensation. It's telling you that in terms of the plan, that red line is not going to be about blowing up wages, but about working on productivity and employing more people, which is what the value for money story all means in terms of the number. It's how you blow up employment in the red line without blowing up compensation or wages. And that's where the ramification for the whole discussion becomes in on whether that can be done. And that's obviously a bargaining and negotiation issue. But I think it's quite clear what the issues are. The plan is saying that government will be an employer. Not blowing up wages. Moving on, Sasha. Coming to law of government capacity, a constitutional and legislative responsibility for provinces to monitor and support law of government. And here, as the SK person pointed out, this is another area that we've expressed a lot of concern on, that monitoring and supporting role of provinces and national and local government, we think really needs to improve. The appropriations bill allocates $763 million for capacity building at local government level. And the impact and outcome of the initiative will be critical if the public sector is tracking more with the limited resources that we're expecting over the NTEF. So the question is, are municipalities going to be able to absorb the funding for capacity conditional grants? And our analysts at the local government level raise questions around capacity grants, especially given how they performed in the past. And so that's another red flag area that this committee needs to follow up quite closely on. And we want to reiterate two past capacity related recommendations here. And the first one is to strictly enforce minimum competencies as the Municipal Finance Management Act to ensure that appropriate technical skills are in place, and then attach conditions capacity grants to commit municipalities to specific, independently verifiable capacity and performance improvements. Those are recommendations that we've made in the past and think are still relevant going forward. Now, through you there, I'll ask Sasha to take over on the two remaining items that we've requested us to comment on. Cost efficiency and other related matters.
Thank you, Ram. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee and other colleagues. Chair, we were asked by the committee to present some ideas on implementing cost efficiency and how the committee can promote this when conducting its oversight. So just to start off with the definition, what cost efficiency implies is the allocation of the smallest amount of resources to reaching a priority. So this is obviously something that is desirable, particularly given our current subdued economic outlook, as described by Dr. Mabogo, and also the call for the 2030 budget to do more with less. But despite the importance of achieving cost efficiency and its desirability, it's quite challenging to do a comprehensive measurement of public sector costs. And if we just look at, for example, the local government here, we still need to do a good and better costing of basic services. But there are two conceptual approaches that can be used to get closer to the cost of services are. And that is the first one is the costed norm method, which was proposed by the Financial and Fiscal Commission in 2001. And just to explain it in three simple steps. What it involves is estimating the average cost of providing a service. And these estimates are usually based on historical estimates of what is being spent on capital, labor, etc. for a given service. Then the second step would be to revise the output standards that you want to reach. So how many teachers do you want to employ, schools that you want to build? Then you would use these estimates of average costs and your output standards that you want to reach, and it is then possible to come up with the total cost of providing a service. The other conceptual approach is using cost function. This is also using this methodology, one can derive the minimum cost of providing a service for a particular province or municipality. But these approaches are also subject to severe limitations because they are quite data intensive. So they are there, but they often require lots of data, which may not be available. Then another aspect to consider when thinking about cost efficiency is the type of cost involved in providing a service. And identifying the major sources of cost can help to prioritize your resources, especially when what you want to achieve is reducing the cost and enhancing efficiency. So we've listed the type of cost there, cost that relate to uncertainty, unpredictability, the fact that we have intermediaries that extract rent, or just costs associated with the political economy of business policy. So what we want to present with us to sort of prescribe what priorities should be selected, but rather to the committee was posing certain questions when conducting its oversight activities. And these key questions that should be asked is, for example, as I mentioned, what are the underlying source of driver costs, where is it primarily and most heavily located in delivery value chain, what is the implementation cost of relaxing the constraints in the national capacity, and then how much is the cost actually dependent on other models. So those are the sorts of considerations that need to be taken on board when trying to achieve greater cost efficiency for the facility. There were also three other related matters that the Commission wishes to bring to the committee's attention. And the first relates to the provincial budget performance. And here, Commissioner, just like welcome the fact that provincial expenditure on personnel is within spending limits for 2012-13, which suggests stricter controls over the provincial wage bill, and also implies that resources for other priority areas are protected from being sacrificed due to personnel expenditure. An aspect of concern is the current high under expenditure on capital assets, as we know that has been a historical problem. And just to look at the opportunity cost of this under expenditure is high if we consider the backlog that exists in our infrastructure at KZN. Then the committee requested some input on activities within the water sector. So basically, the total departmental allocation for the Department of Water Affairs for 2013 is 10.2 billion, which is up by 1.43 billion from the previous financial year. 41% of the 10.2 billion is in respect of conditional grant funding, and the majority of conditional grant funding is with respect to the regional bulk infrastructure project in district. And important when it comes to working with municipalities is to ensure that adequate support is provided such that the funds are spent. In terms of spending performance, what we've noted is that most funds are spent in the last quarter of the financial year, and this suggests that the department may be experiencing some challenges within their budget monitoring processes. And just which reflects the broader problem of inadequate financial management systems in place. So that is something to note. Then in terms of job creation, the department has, through its Working for Water project, created 28,400 jobs during the 2011-12 financial year. And the Commission just welcomes the activeness of the Department of Water Affairs in setting up an array of initiatives that aim at providing better support to the local government here. Just to note, one of them is the establishment of the Rapid Response Unit to address local government emergencies such as flood, pollution of water, etc. So, you know, this is where the culture of peer learning and emulating aspects of good practice should be promoted. And then moving on to the Department of Human Settlements, which is the final other related matter. As we know, the aim of the department is to facilitate the creation of sustainable human settlements. And this is implemented using an array of conditional grants, such as your human settlements development grant, the rural household infrastructure grant, and the urban settlement development grant. If I can just take you to the next slide, which illustrates the performance of these grants between 2019 and rejections up to 2015-16. What we noted that with respect to the Human Settlements Development Grant, the performance has been good and there's been a high level of expenditure relative to the allocation, as you can see, 98% spent in 2011-12. But when we get to the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant, spending as at January 2013 is at 70.9%. So, we see poor performance from inception, and given current indications of poor performance is set to continue. Members would also be aware that this grant was recently changed to a Schedule 5B or a direct grant, where previously it was an indirect grant. Then the final grant is the Urban Settlement Development Grant, and again we see poor performance since inception in 2011. 44% of the grant spent as of January this year, again 45% spent. So again, performance looking to be poor. So, Chair, this is just a brief overview of the three programs that are key to contributing to our human settlement development priorities. And as you can see, there's a definite need to ramp up the ability in the allocated funds. I'll hand back over to Mr. Kamara to conclude.
Thank you, Sasha. I think, the Chair, this has been quite a long presentation. A lot of issues that actually arise from it. And maybe instead of me reading through these conclusions, I think I did say quite a number of things in the beginning that speak to these conclusions. I think it's on consolidation from the perspective of the Commission is something that needs to be supported. And we need to, in the conduct of such an exercise, to also keep our focus on the impact on short-run growth, on the potential for longer growth, and also looking at the supporting institutional capability and accountability frameworks that are required to ensure that the resources are actually spent in the right area. I must say, Chairperson, that in the last 2 weeks, we signed a memorandum of understanding with the Public Service Commission to share some work, to work together on some of the key issues that we think our mandates actually coincide, even though with a different purpose. We as a Commission will be concerned with the way in which financial resources are utilized and the cost of such a misutilization of resources, whereas the Public Service Commission might be concerned with the efficiency of utilization of resources and the accountability framework. Now, there are obvious synergy in that type of work, and one of the programs that we have identified as a key area to kick off
public service and what the cost of corruption is in terms of the fiscal and government, the attainment of government programs. So there is some work that we will be doing with the Public Service Commission around that last bullet point that, that hopefully we'll be able to report or something in the coming year. Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity to share our position.
Thank you, Bakuma. So you say the issues of the around the cost of the corruption will be contained in the last in that last list. Thank you very much for the comprehensive presentation. That's going on with health care. Just to indicate that on Tuesday evening, the public service intrigued by some of the presentations.
Honourable members, Honourable staff.
Chief, I think the acting the ultimate issue was got corruption, that you are going to look at that specifically. But thank you very much for the very good presentation, and if we can succeed in defending what you say we should be achieving, then this country will go somewhere. Just on page 9, my question there is that golf. Growth and expenditure components 8.3 for compensation of employees down to 1.3. Is that realistically achievable with trade unions as they are at the moment and government trade unions insisting on much higher than the normal sort of inflationary increases? Thanks. I also like to thank the Commission for their input. And I welcome the memorandum which is signed with the Public Service Commission. I think by putting your head together we can go a long way. But I don't know, I'm not directly related to any of the slides here, but maybe to what I picked up from the inputs in respect of your fiscal consolidation and the accountability framework. If I understand maybe what you mean by your fiscal consolidation, with respect to the kind of governance structure that we have to work with in the Constitution, 43% of your budget is going to province, which you haven't got any form of direct central control over, because those legislators are appropriating funds. The accountability framework is that they account, those departments account back to those legislatures. Those legislatures haven't got any direct accountability to national, maybe to a limited extent through the MCOP. So you're losing 43% of your direct funds to be able to achieve the national objective that you want to do. So that to me, I think, some kind of a problem. Well, sir, you speak about the provinces giving support to local government, and that's really not there to an extent within province. Although the Constitution also states that nationals should give support to provinces. So, in effect, it's a national responsibility, if you look at it, to ensure that local government is working. Okay. But that system of capacitating down the chain, there's a problem with it. Okay. Because we're trying to once again work within the framework of cooperative governance. Okay. Then your norms and standards, to me, they must be through legislation. Or through legislation, norms and standards should be adopted. National level. But that then is going to change the whole manner in which budgets are allocated. Although the Constitution speaks about progressively achieving certain targets, but I don't see how you're going to be able to legislate on every single norms and standards of a Public Service Commission. Would you not be able to put your head together to say, what kind of superstructure or governance superstructure would ideally achieve what we want to achieve in a developmental state, and to be able to get the best value for money that we can out of the fiscus? Thanks.
I'll start with page 19 on the last bullet of capacity limit recommendation. Because we have, I'm glad the FSC to give you on the system that seem to be put in place and how effective they are in related to their past recommendations. Because the national president tells us about this DAO. And we also hear from local government about this NISA. It keeps on changing. I don't know how long it will be NISA. So we'd like to know that based on your own previous recommendations, do you think these systems that are put in place are effective, or what should be happening? Because if, as we say, conditions should be put in this capacity grant, I think that is the best thing. But how effective are the existing mechanisms that are put in place too? Because we are also concerned about lack of service delivery, and the fact that every day we are aware that there's no capacity there. And the slide on labor, and those three, the red one going very well, I think. Where do we find our SOEs here? Because the development financial grant, and how do you think they should be, where do you think they should be placed? Because they know their government support and institutions. Because I think we let us link ourselves to them. And I think this, where should the EPWPs be going? Because the development, National Development Plan has a very good thing where they talk about the way they, where they should be going. They shouldn't just social development and like taking anybody from the street, turning them into a teacher in the preschool, and then you see we really worked very hard because we've produced EPWP. Do those things need to be checked in line with the real what the EPWP says? Because right now they are not aligned with just want to see how long. Because they have a great impact on the education of our children.
Thank you, Chair. I'm actually on page 29 conclusions, and then it is slide. My first question is you mentioned there that resources are generally efficient, the allocated priority areas. Indeed, it remains for government to improve spending. Now, do you see the problem lies with bad management in the departments, capacity, or what? Because we received for the last 3-4 years now the so-called authority reports. And that's quite clear that in these reports, the page more or less the same if you look at the departments. Now, to me, it's only one thing, and that is bad management. I want to hear your comment on that. And then also, also, I think, it's a certainty of government in promises as we did that already making things by
on your greater focus on improving small business development. And I agree with you on that. I think that's tremendously important. My question is there enough training for the entrepreneurs? If you focus on job creation, is there enough training for I want to come back to that. Is there enough money for data? Is there enough money for the young entrepreneurs? We saw now this week that the program I think was the program. But the big thing is still are there enough the program is just made, but is there enough trainers, enough mentors? And I think that is the thing that we must aim to be. There's enough skills around this country. All of these are of things, but they want but they not be as a focus, but focus to bring in much more mentors and to pass business in this country and bring in people data. Information that we can say, listen, there we have 40, 50 projects that can be great jobs, but there are your mentors and make use of the mentors. Pay them as they are, pay them a certain amount, but by certain after 6 months, there are people who are in business, run business, create jobs, but the most important, they create jobs for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, but I have to add, I like the introduction, kind of worried me at times. The very first or second page, on page 2, on page 2, well, on 3, first one. Oh, this is what? The first page. We led to the underlying message on the authority of a test to address the root cause of the fourth document. Increasingly, negative elements that spread on this. Something comes up at point. I think it's when history is in commission, believe that challenges that lie in technical financial management intervention, but in the political. Strong administration interface and implant. Can you tell us expatiate a bit in terms of exactly what is it that you're seeing here? Dr. Mabur says the Keynesian philosophy is self-identity in 1980s. That's what you would think. But the, again, on the, I think this is not correct, that part. Why is it seems like South Africa was experiencing more pressure? I don't know if the interpretation is correct today. But if it is correct, why is it the case? But second, I know that the South Africans have joined the group. Is there a hope of turning things around as South Africa is joining a BRIC? And clearly from the European side, as Dr. Mabu was saying, is that the
whilst on the other hand, other developing economies, for instance, are experiencing growth, but South Africa doesn't seem to be having the same response as other developing countries. What is the reason for that? Of the compensation of employees. I wasn't sure whether you were saying that this is under control, but I think that the narrative report seems to be saying that as is. Is that what you were saying? But some people are saying it seems to be posing a problem in the long term because of the continuous demand for increments that the public service, demand, continue to demand. Okay, maybe for now, let's just stop there. I don't know if there's any addition. Okay, thank you. Thank you, thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for another group members. I think
the last of tomorrow is the undistribution of the resources for the seven, with something for the 3 years. For local government. Is this, does this include, is this consolidated budget, including the debt payment by national government, that's 27%, for instance? Or is it excluded from the
your last question and Honorable question are basically the same. But what we must first of all reach is that for the first time in 2012, the agreement, all the wage increases in a multi-year agreement is actually aligned to the MTF. So if we say that both parties would adhere to what has been agreed to, so those numbers must be, by that, must be achievable. There's no backtracking around that, so those numbers must be achievable. Secondly, I think what's more important in respect of, in particular, your question, Honorable Sogon, is the concern is that the current composition, because what we have there is just the changes in the composition, so that's the growth, but it's not actually looking at the actual share of the wage bill, which would be different. So it's just growth numbers, how it's been growing. And certainly, I think, again, I'll come back to you, Honorable Swat, I think looking, because we have, in fact, in our submission that will be tabling in the next week, which is our submission for the Division of Revenue 2014-15. We have actually looked at the key drivers in the wage bill in the provincial sphere, and we have numbers that basically demonstrate that this is actually being
has actually been hidden and being implemented in the provinces around trying to arrest the growth in the public sector wage bill. I think what is important in that regard is also the issue that Dr. Mabogo was speaking to, which is about the composition within that wage bill. What is driving the growth? And if it's not related to productivity, then it's useless in terms of what we want to achieve. Even if we say we reduce it and then we increase on infrastructure, but if it's not productive over in the long term, then it's useless. So the composition is also important to look at. But all the people that are sitting behind desks and not actually doing the job that are leading to that, even if it's 1.3% growth, is still not actually making the desired impact in terms of where we want to go. I suppose each sector themselves, at least in the government sector, that's what we are focusing on. We are trying to that message, saying that message has been hidden. Now, whether in the private sector we have the same kind of thing, and certainly we don't, because the message is one look at the agreements that have been struck now, compared to what has been agreed over the 3 years for the public sector, there's obviously a problem. There's a serious disjunction, and that can potentially can also have implications on the region. So that's something that is beyond the control of government, so it's outside the control of government. Then let's look at a few questions that, because I'm going to share the questions with Dr. Mabogo anyway. Honorable Helen Bloom, you asked about the number of municipalities, whether we've got too many municipalities. I would say, you know, one can't say off the cuff that we've got too many municipalities, because if we think about where we came from, well over 3,000 municipalities, down to about 800, now we're down to about 293. So we've been looking at different sets of criteria and looking at the functional assignments and trying to create the most useful municipalities as possible. Now what I'm saying is that we also at the Commission have an MOU with the Municipal Demarcation Board. And partly it was driven, that MOU was driven by what we felt was the need to share our capacity with the MDB in terms of the assessment of the viability of certain and sustainability of certain different types of municipalities. Because all of these things happen because people apply for redemarcation on the basis of this. So the demarcation board has to deal with those things. But they have to conduct certain work, background work, to check whether if you actually do that kind of redemarcation, does it actually make sense? This municipality is going to be sustainable. So two of my most senior people in the commission are actually working with the demarcation board. That's Dr. Mabogo and another Dr. Nguyen, that are actually working with the demarcation board around that very question. So I wouldn't say off the cuff, because there's work that is actually happening around sustainability of these municipalities from a long-term point of view. So I can't give you a very straight answer, is yes or no. Right. Honorable Mashiho asks about the effectiveness of systems in relation to the recommendations that you are making around local government capacity. And you specifically referred to the Treasury, the Technical Assistance Unit, and the CICOGS, Municipal Infrastructure Support Agency. In the context of local government, MISA and TAU, I would say, are relatively new pairs. The TAU has already been there, but the focus has been with different spheres of government, so national, provincial, and local. So there was no specific program targeted at the local government. But the Treasury has a capacity building and capacity grant for job welcome. So what happens is that with the forming of the Senzamani project, you would recall the Senzamani project, and I think we made a very detailed submission, both looking at the closing report from the DBSA and also looking at the experiences that we had actually picked up during the implementation of that program. And obviously there were a number of weaknesses that were identified and solutions proposed into how the two programs, because what the result of that was that there was a separation of this infrastructure on the one side, basis the people, and that gave birth to the municipal infrastructure support agency, and then the assistance that comes from the national treasury on the other side that deals with financial management and types of issues. So the effectiveness of this, and I would say that this is probably 2012-13 was the first year that the two were split from so we haven't actually made any assessment of what the effectiveness has been. But one of the recommendations that we made was that there needs to be a clear process or protocol of cooperation between the various line departments, especially on the minister side, various line departments that are implementing different types of infrastructure grants with different municipalities and minister. Because that's one of the things that was happening, was that there was a lack of intergovernmental coordination or cooperation in terms of implementation of the Senzamani project. So some people would be coming here doing this, and other people are coming here doing that, and as a result, the confusion in the planning process. That was one of the issues that came out of our own assessment. So what I'm saying is that it's important that as we interact with those institutions, I must say that the last time as a commission that we interacted with MISA was when they came to explain to us where they were with the process of establishing themselves. They were also looking for office accommodation. So we haven't seen what the actual program that they are running with, but my assumption is that they took over what was from Senzamani, but now focused on what MISA is supposed to be focusing on, and hopefully the process has taken into consideration some of the recommendations that we made. So we haven't actually assessed the effectiveness of this program since they have been restructured. They are pretty new. Even though the treasury one has already been there, it's been established, what we have raised in the past has been around spending on that conditional grant that meant for financial support towards that. I can't remember what it's called, I'm sure Sasha will call what the grant is, but it's one of those grants that have been performing very well. And that's the question that we've been asking around that. There was a question, I'm just being selective, on the issue of the Northern Standards. I think, and what the honorable member is raising is that might imply a certain approach to budget allocation. I think the question of Northern Standards on its own is that we need certain Northern Standards, at least basic minimum Northern Standards for service delivery. I think the Constitution expects that from national departments, whether it's like you legislate or you, not even regulations are part and parcel of your legislative process. So in one way or another, you actually need to have that. Otherwise, you can't even be able to measure progress towards that, because the Constitution talks about progressive realization. So there's many rights, but we also have progressive realization, and if you don't have a base, it's very difficult to then measure your progress. Now, it's even more complicated in situations where the resource envelope is shrinking and you don't have those knowledge standards, but demands don't change with the size of the envelope. And so when you have to make decisions on what to know that you must pay people, it's very easy to do that on the front line. It's not so easy to do that on the service side. So welfare services, for example, we probably don't have. And the service that people get with respect to those grants and access the one time to get those grants on time and all of those things, those are other things that are associated. So it's not like you don't have to say minimum you must receive your grant within 7 minutes. In other countries, they probably do say that, monitor. So if I was to designate you to be served for a passport, for example, if you go to Thailand and you go beyond 7 minutes, then in a queue you haven't been attended, you must just punch something that will say that the civil servant did not meet the... So it's all of those things. Obviously, at the point they have implications for whatever the resources that you have. But I think it's important that you have at least on concurrent function at least minimum levels of it's important. In economic development, I mean, we spent quite some time having discussions with the economic development department. And one of the questions that we asked was whether, as a commission, we understand the role of economic development at a provincial level and the priorities that at the national level are there, and how, from an intergovernmental relations point of view, how do we raise the importance? The similar thing with tourism. We don't. But when allocations are made, what we know is that in that formula that we have for allocation across provinces, your economic development, tourism, falls under what we call other. So the other is someone to say you know what your functions are around it, so that you must make available for health, education, welfare, and then the other. It's almost like you're not prioritizing those at the same level as, but that's not the idea. And so those discussions basically would then inform at some point when priorities change, what is the role of the province. I think that's what the key message Dr. Mabungu was trying to raise when he was saying for provinces to play a role that is growth enhancing. We have in the past tried to measure what provinces' growth impact is and relative to its developmental impact compared to municipalities, and we've got stories around it. So the important thing is just that we need to have minimum standards and norms around this type of statutory concurrent function to move it forward. The issue around the capacity of a local government and strengthening the system, I think what the presentation assumes, I'm sure that they probably cut out differently in the written submission itself, around the need for the constitutionalness of responsibility for national government and provincial government to support municipalities. The relevant sections are 139 and 154, I think, that actually speak about those things. And I think it's important in the fact that what we are saying is that there's a lot of money, especially on the infrastructure side, but quite a significant amount speaks to what is happening in the local government sphere. Now, in a separate report that we tabled about 2-3 weeks ago on the local government fiscal framework, one of the issues that we raised is that in the vertical division of revenue, on the operational side, local government is well funded. But on the capital side, which is the infrastructure, which speaks to the investment dimension of this discussion, we probably are not meeting the fiscal gap vertically. But we are also raising an issue there that current vertical division of revenue. It's actually money that belongs to national departments. It comes through national departments. It must be spent at local government for a specific, pre-identified purposes. Now, who must take responsibility for the level of capacity to spend money? Obviously, it has to be the national department and the provincial department together with local, taking collective responsibility for that. And the constitution basically says these two must actually support capacity building. So it's not a very clever thing to actually, as a department, celebrate the withholding of money that has not been spent by a municipality on a program that you are supposed to do. It's not very clever to celebrate that. So that is the issue that we're trying to raise, is that the responsibility and accountability must actually start from the top. Because the priority, the national priority, we must actually assume shared responsibility for it and not just say the local state, local government level. And therefore we will withhold the money. It's okay. And I think it's important also that you raise, honorable member, that this also speaks to the accountability chain. So if you give money to the province, they've got their own legislature, they must account, they've made the NCOP, there's this process that is actually result in accountability at the national level. But they can take their own decision. But cooperative governance basically assumes that those are taken collectively. And therefore, we must be optimistic about the decisions that will be taken if we have shared ownership of the program that we're actually looking at. So that is where, from our side, we take it in good faith, that whatever decisions are taken in good faith. And where they are not taken in good faith, which basically now will bring me to the story around the issue of how do you then hold people to account if we are saying that we are consolidating fiscally and then different levels must spend this much and if they go beyond. We've got this thing which is not exactly a fiscal rule, but it is a substitute. So if you adopt the fiscal framework, you adopt the division of revenue bill, and then you put over and above that you put the PFMA, you've got a very strong framework with which to manage decisions that you're taking around the budget. So the only thing that is left there, because I think one of the questions that I have always had to answer in areas where, especially when you have to have discussions with ministers or with customers, is that that chapter 13 and PFMA give too much responsibility to technocrats and political decisions because of who must account. And it comes back to your question about political administration. If you really were to implement the PFMA as it was supposed to be, as it was drafted, that discussion does not come into play. Because there are sanctions for any violations and all of that. So if we decide that this is at a national level, this is what we want to spend and this is how we want to spend, and everybody spends responsibly in terms of the agreed priorities and also comply the issues that we're talking about. And I think that's the reason why, from our side, when we were requested by the minister to make comment on the fiscal rules, whether we needed fiscal rules in South Africa, we were saying, no, we've got sufficient framework to actually deal with those kinds of potential fiscal irresponsibilities that might arise, because we've got national legislation to deal with that. So we have the instrument to control that. So it's not a concern. The concern is when those have to be implemented. And I think Honorable Sokoni, on to your question around taking the political administrative interface, I can't remember what page it is on in the National Development Plan. There is a story there about the need to professionalize the public Commission has also raised that kind of a question to a significant degree in relation to the instability at senior management in government, with just people being shifted from here to there and shifted from here to there, and following political cycle or political changes. So you get this kind of movement. Those can actually prove to be very destabilizing in terms of implementation of strategies for the various units or something. So I think it's important that we clarify that when we raise this, we are actually talking about creating a stable and professional civil service rather than just trying to have a discussion around who must actually appoint who in it, what level, and all of that. That is a separate process, a separate discussion. I'm going to suggest another one that is okay. You also raised the issue of I think that those are Ramos questions on the graph that you were talking about. Let me just give you space to respond to those questions that speak to the graphs and what they include and what they don't.
I think there was a question on why is South Africa experiencing more pressure. I think we can give the economic, that one. I think it's why that red line is more than the black line, the world take is an average of the world, not just the countries that caused the global recession. So you have only your China that was growing at 6-7%, even with other countries and recession being lumped in that black one. So they tend to diminish the impact on the world economic growth. Pushing it upward. And that's why South Africa felt more impact than the world as a complete total. It's because the world is a basket of the good performance and the really bad performance. But if you were just to put what we call the developed countries, for instance, those were hit much higher than South Africa on its own. Yeah. So here we are picking up it's still classifying in the country category. Although it lends to the developed countries. Yeah, so that explains that normal. Then the next crucial question one will bring us to South Africa in turning things around. And I think that's a very good and difficult question. The answer lies around two things, all located in sphere of international trade. The first is the flow of goods and services within the BRICS community. What is going to be the nature of flow of the goods that we produce and sell as well as buy final goods? The second aspect is going to be the flow of sectors of production, in other words, capital and labor within a BRICS community. One could think of a situation where South Africa is saying one of our most binding constraints is a skills shortage if you buy into that argument. So a reason to be optimistic about BRICS is that there is huge skills in China, India, Brazil, you name it. And those are going to flood our market big time, thereby softening the cost conflict. If we think skill is an issue that's constraining us from growing. So, the second element, again, on whether skill is our biggest constraint, is open for grabs. I think members raised the issue that is it really that we face a skill shortage or an organization type shortage. So, we may not get, never will get that dividend, but if we really suffer from a skill shortage, then one engine for growth from clicks will be towards softening that growth conflict. Now on goods and services, this one is fairly tricky. I say it's fairly tricky in the sense that when you look at what South Africa sells currently to those economies in the main, it's resources that we sell to those economies. And most of our manufactured products go into the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, not so much into countries that are in BRICS. So if you want to get a growth driver from the BRICS, it means we must open up new markets for manufactured products in those countries. So that will be a new area for growth that we didn't have before. The market for resources, minerals, etc., we already have even when we offered the BRICS. So we didn't need to be a BRICS for us to benefit from selling minerals to those countries. But what we didn't have is the market for manufactured commodities. Now the question is, will we access those markets for manufactured commodities? And already we know that Chinese products so cheap, let me use that term, and for one to even dream of capturing that contested space. No, I mean cheap in terms of retail value, how much you pay for the product. So so that's where a lot of rethinking is really required. That where the new engines can come from are through the skills and possibly importation of technology, and whether we can capture the manufactured commodities. I haven't looked into the feasibility studies that were done in addressing those questions, but those, in terms of oversight, would be the questions that I would ask in terms of whether those drivers for future economic growth are known with a bit of certainty so that we can reap the great dividend in the trade. It won't be minimal for itself because we already have that we can export as much minerals as we want, even in the current environment. What will be the implications of a long recession in the European Union? Luckily, what we've worked out before, 2010 spoke of a severe scenario. And that severe scenario is precisely the scenario that you're facing about a sustained EU recession. And the arithmetic is extremely bad. Is there a chance of switching from EU to BRICS? That's again that channel that I spoke about the goods and services, whether you can redirect the traffic that was going to EU into the BRICS. The rest of Africa, I don't mention because that's already available. So it's not a new, lever or new engine for growth. You already have it. Yeah. It's growing from a low base. So it needs to continue to be measured for another 20, 50 years. Growing and the results they are growing for it to start helping. But in terms again of the risk that we're talking about, if now you change your eggs from EU basket into the BRICS basket, the question is what are the risks of a recession within the BRICS? Pretty much in terms of risk analysis, the optimal strategy is continuous diversification, not to close off market, but to continuously diversify and not taking all your eggs in the buying basket like we have done. But I would say in terms of a take-home message, that will be the intervention where we continue fighting for diversification. And then the question was raised, Honorable Bumashiko, around the EPWP debt scheme, whether the management spend is sufficient, whether it makes sense to get someone from the city and then say he is a trainer. I think the answer for that question is it depends on what part of the cycle one is on. If you are undergoing a big recession and people are dying from subject in the house, etc., one doesn't want to put too much conditions into life strategy. But if you now want to convert it into a job strategy, where you are going. Now one is to really think about how to scale up EPWP in a way that leads to a substantial job. So once we have negotiated our way out of the recession, then it starts making sense to think of ways of really scaling this back in a nice program way in the manner that we are looking to. So it depends on what part of the cycle we are in. Sometimes you will find that by having as stable conditions as possible, and because people are dying on the street from the recession, you want to pretend that you don't see what's happening. Because you know that ultimately you are leading the people staying alive. But then when you negotiate the cycle before the recession, you want to put in a much more structured intervention. That is all the nice structures that you spoke about. I don't know, is the one that I have missed?
I think the diagnostic tool that she was proposing
fits in quite nicely with the elimination strategy that we're using to for you to come to a stage where you said, I think it's action based management, because we're eliminating all, and we're beginning to try to think to develop that diagnostic tool where we look at what are driving constraints to ascertaining that you're already thinking in that, because of a very highly structured and extremely good analysis that are buying, that you continue lacking the constraint until you find the one that you think is the most buying the constraint. Yes, in this case, the bank management. I would say I agree with, because you're going through the process, but I would say let's for Sasha's work, it gives me hope that if she continues nourishing that tool, which is about identifying concerns and waking up their relationship to the whole of the system, taking into account all the political considerations, to attain the whole delivery chain, until you say this is three constraints for us to focus on. I really like that analytical tool. And, you demonstrated it extremely well, in my opinion. But so is management. But there is the tool in action. that's what Sasha, in terms of diagnostic, she's saying that's how we should go about eliminating the real big drivers of the problem.
For example, if you move into finance with budget.
a capital project, you actually have a completely different set of arrangements, and that is where some of us have been at odds. So we can see where it works and where it actually doesn't work. With a budget council, I can give you an example of what used to happen in the past. They used to have what they called an extended budget council committee. That would actually be budget council and then some amendments to deal with issues that affect that sector. And starting from the technical level, I think they still do those technical committees, the 4x4, 10x10, whatever, to try and address some of those issues. But there are only a few departments that you actually have those kinds of arrangements for. And whether that system actually works effectively is a question that must still be answered by maybe some of the people in the university that can come in with a very different outside perspective of what is actually happening within the institution. Because I can say from my side that in finance in South Africa, the institutional arrangements, I think they have worked pretty well over the past 15 or so years. They worked pretty well because there's clear norms and standards. They probably have also by the fact that in the constitution itself, there's a prescription of what the Minister of Finance is responsible for. So you need enabling legislation to do this, you need enabling legislation to do that. So all of those things are there. So once you put those things in place, institutionally you are ready to go. And that's what actually, in some of the departments, some of the sectors, is actually missing. So you will find that we've had so many MINLEGs for a very long time, those MINLEGs had no legislative standing. So they were just like a gap because people need to cooperate. So you establish this legally, there's nothing. Whereas the budget council, if you look at the Intergovernmental Fiscalization Act, it establishes the budget council. So there's a legislative framework for how it should actually operate and who should be in that council. So all of those things matter. And so the question that you're asking is very relevant. And across a number of areas, we find that local government, for example, does not actually feature. Whereas in that budget council thing, you got the budget forum that extends, and it's also legislated. So whether the participation of the sector is effective in the institution itself is a different set of issues. But certainly, institutionally, you got the arrangement, which should, if we're living in an ideal world, it should have been working. And so we will pick up that challenge together with Public Service Commission, definitely, to actually have a look at the systems, whether they actually support the system of the government of the Federation. I think it's a very interesting area that we need to look at.
Thank you.
I wonder if Department of Water has ever invited you to come and say, or just came out of yourself to look at what is happening in water. Because something is definitely not right there. Because if you appropriate for a department that has such big possibility in addressing the constitutional issues of basic human rights. And when we talk to them, you'll hear that, no, this budget comes from the department. And this WTE is an entity that raises funds. But no one talks about people who don't have water. And then water boards. They all have something that is very, very good and addresses this basic sexism. But there's nothing happening, there's underpinning. You let me to hear about that tunnel, tunnel something. They all have that very, very good home that at the end of the day should address basic service of the most important thing, water, which is the cheapest commodity so far. And when we talk to them, nothing comes out of this. there's no, nothing comes out there. We see that the infrastructure is breaking. People don't have water. We do deal with the municipality because we don't know how they buy their water, where they buy from. Do you have any documentation or anything that you have done that can assist us that whenever we need the department, because we use so much of them, but at the end of the day, we leave that space with the same thing, that we don't even know what's right in their report. Do we have anything that can really assist us? That's when we deal with the department, we should know where the money is going to and who is not doing her way, her or his thing.
Let me just confirm with any document outside of the budget dollars that we have on board.
In our written submission, we have provided an overview of the budget as well as the performance of the department as well. But it's a very summarized version, so I'm not sure if we can provide you with something more detailed, which speaks a bit more detail in terms of the issues that we are increasing.
Let me just say, Honorable, that if there are very specific areas that the committee would like to follow up with the department and would like a view from the commission, I think we would be happy to respond to any specific special request from the committee that we can actually prepare something for you, but you would need to actually indicate the kind of issues that you really want the commission's opinion or views around. So we can actually do that, because I think on our current research on basic services, we haven't separated water as a separate kind of an issue. We have water together with electricity. I think that's on the basic services and backlog and all of that, which is content in our submission that is coming next week to Parliament. But if there are very specific issues that would like us to look at with regard to water, and I think when I was having discussions with the team that was putting together the submission, I actually raised the issue of TCTA as well, that we've got all of the entities that are supposed to have some, in one way or another, supposed to have some capacity or some capacity there to do this. How do we can bring everything together so that we can actually, because there are a whole range of issues. I must say that I've been following some of the debate around water, and I've been attending some conferences at the international level that actually deal with water in South Africa and water governance in South Africa. And it's quite a range of issues, some of them that are quite they're very interesting. They are shocking. Let me put it that way. Let me use the word that some of the things that actually come up that tend to be quite shocking in terms of the amount of losses, the costs involved, and a whole range of issues. But we can actually respond to that if you would like us to send us a return with specific areas that you want us to address, because it's quite broad. Now, thank you very much, I think, Mr. Mashito, for raising this point. That maybe this, when are we getting that question? I think we still have time. I think that the program is 29th of May. But maybe even the presentation that is in front of us, the narrative one, not the I think that maybe if we could look at it as the if we could look
next week, then we can come back to have a chance to look at it. Maybe next week we will come back to the LFC. But I think that the point that our national is raising, our observation in general of the economy, but also LFC for flagging water affairs, but also the complexities of the chain, that supply chain from water affairs to local government, you know, because sometimes, I mean, to the public out there and to us, that water affairs, the people in a certain village want water, people they want water. People don't know that this level now no longer what happened. It's a local government or district or what people want water. That's all. But it's nothing that I think we're the same to. I mean, we still need to work in this in the way things function. Because earlier I made a comment, for instance, that the National Department will say our responsibility ends here, and the local government will give you money. If you understand it, we take that money back. And the question that the committee will raise, the question that we are raising, we raise it every year, is to say, if you would hold this fund, in whose interest are we doing that? People are sitting there in offices, they have not performed their work, the funds are withheld, at the end of the month, they still get paid. We don't say that you haven't performed, and therefore you would not get paid because you haven't. Then the issue that you raised, I think the AG has raised as well, about the consequences, that is the word that I'm looking for, about the consequences. People know that if you have not performed, it's fine. Uh-huh. I have performed, nobody has performed, I'm sorry, I didn't perform. But now for people who want the service, now if it is with health, they really suffer. Already in the meeting for services, then none of my people then go to their constituents and say, sorry, you can't get water because the national salary has repaired the fund. Because the department has performed. Do you think that people will listen to you if it is difficult? They will fight with you. So all that the people want, which really what happened in the past few years is kind of dodged the situation of by saying devolving certain responsibilities to the state, to someone else. And we have been asking this question, why do you do that? Because when there's no capacity, when this does not accompanied by capacity, so that there is so that the service is delivered. People will tell you that the infrastructure is best that we're talking about. You go to my village, you buy a tent, but if you open the tent, there's no water. But it makes sense to say, no, the infrastructure is there. People don't want it. But they want the water from that tent. And I think that is a very much change. That is a challenge in water affairs. So,
after the challenges that sometimes this station don't arise as very as we love them to. But the issue around what happens is that maybe there's the emphasis that is not covered will come back yourself. Maybe it may not only be what happens, could be the other departments. For instance, I saw in the last meeting that we were with Water Affairs, luckily we were there. So we said to Water Affairs, we would like them to come back in terms of this refactoring of the, which is of course, of the local government equitable share, but I also respect Water Affairs. We support that, but it will really not make sense not accompanied by a capacity building. So that's them. We'd like to have a conversation with them before the beginning of the year, because we could want ourselves to be sure that it was a result in improving service delivery, you know, and feel that our program